Hi, Undisclosed listeners, Rabia here. We have wrapped up with last week's episode, our relaunch season, covering so much more on Adnan's case. And of course, this case just never ends. There's always more information to be discussed. However, you're probably wondering what's next. Folks have asked, what's going to happen now to Undisclosed that you did this season? Well, just like in classic Undisclosed style, we are going to come back to you every year with new seasons on new cases, and we have one prepared for you for this fall. However, unlike classic Undisclosed, what we are switching up is this. In between seasons, we're going to be doing kind of talk show style episodes where we either interview folks, we'll do update episodes, we'll talk about, you know, news. We're going to be in your ear every single week, so you stay subscribed so you don't miss out on when we are back doing our classic deep dive investigations. So this week, we have kind of a treat for you. And this is also related to Adnan's case because, like I said, this is the gift that keeps on giving. However, as we discussed in the episode titled The Prosecutor, Baltimore City State's Attorney Ivan Bates withdrew the motion to vacate Adnan's conviction. He did this earlier this year. He filed an 88-page motion listing all the reasons he wanted to withdraw it. But he mostly attacked the investigation that Marilyn Mosby's office conducted that led to them vacating Adnan's conviction and then even eventually dropping charges. Well, the person who led that investigation under Marilyn Mosby was attorney Becky Feldman. And this week, we've got a special treat for you because Becky is joining us to give us an interview to talk about that investigation and what led them to file the motion to vacate. And we wanted to get responses from her to Ivan Bates' motion to withdraw and all of the allegations and accusations he made in that. So I'm going to introduce Becky. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her, and then we'll get right into the interview. Becky Feldman has been a Maryland post-conviction attorney for about 17 years. She served as the chief of the Maryland Public Defender's post-conviction division for 3 years and then was promoted to be the deputy of the Maryland Office of the Public Defender in 2017 for 3 years. That's where she helped to manage all of the public defender offices across the state. Becky has litigated post-conviction matters in front of 22 of Maryland's 24 county circuit courts. She has trained innumerable attorneys through the years, and her practice has focused almost exclusively on the most serious cases, those involving murder or rape charges, where you have life or life without parole sentences. It was that depth and breadth of experience that led to her being selected as the top candidate to lead the Baltimore City State's Attorney's newly created Sentence Review Unit in 2020. Her unit reviewed nearly 200 cases over 2 years and focused on individuals who had already served decades in prison, at least 20 years if they were under 18 at the time of their conviction, or 25 years otherwise. Ultimately, Becky's team recommended reduced sentences or vacated charges in about 50 cases, and judges granted relief in 43 of them. And the Adnan Syed case was only one of the 200 cases that Becky was assigned to review. Becky Feldman left the practice of law in March 2025, which also marked the 25th anniversary of her brother's murder. And we're going to hear all about that from her as well. So there is so much for us to talk about. You know, I have introduced you to our audience. A lot of folks don't know a lot about you because you were working mostly behind the scenes. Mosby was kind of the face of the state's attorney's office. Obviously, she was when you were there. And I didn't know a whole lot about you either until very recently when I started learning about kind of what propelled you into the work and the career that you did. And it really was both inspiring and heartbreaking. So I was wondering if you didn't mind kind of sharing your personal background and story that got you here.
Yes. So I was originally interested in becoming a forensic psychologist. I'm a psychology major, and I went to law school thinking that that would be an interesting path to take so I could learn more about criminology.
And you're a Maryland native? Like you're from Maryland?
Yes.
Okay. Baltimore specifically?
Baltimore County. And yeah, my family's been here for generations. So we came and we never left. And I went to Loyola in Baltimore. I went to the University of Baltimore Law School. So anyway, in my first year of law school, my brother was shot and killed in March of 2000 in Baltimore City. He was sitting in his car, waiting to meet some people who were setting him up and were going to rob him. They shot him in the head and he died immediately. Two people were arrested for the offense. It was a 17-year-old and a 20-year-old. And so my family went through this process of, you know, having this tragedy happen, working with homicide detectives and a prosecutor throughout the whole thing. And it was traumatic. It was eye-opening. And they did secure two guilty pleas for both of them, 22 years and 35 years for the shooter. And coming away from that experience, I remember walking out of the courthouse feeling like I could breathe again. Like just having someone held accountable, and whatever that meant, that didn't mean life sentences in this particular case. And that was okay for us. And I decided at that point, I need to get into this work.
I mean, you were already in law school, but you had never considered working in criminal law, right? Until
no, not at all. I didn't even want to be an attorney. I know that sounds strange, going to law school and not wanting that. I just wanted the experience and the knowledge of law school because I thought that would help. It would help my liberal arts brain work in a different way. So yeah, I was first year of law school, 23 years old. My brother was 22 years old.
Wow.
It's just the two of us. It was always just the two of us. And so, yeah, that started my journey.
I can't even imagine. Were you able to continue law school through something like this? Did you have to like stop for a little bit and gather yourself again?
I didn't stop. And the reason is it was more helpful to me to make myself get up in the morning and drive myself to school than not, because the alternative would have been, you know, just laying around the house and being very, you know, distraught all the time. And so I kind of forced myself out of that a little bit. And I think I was on autopilot, honestly. I'm not suggesting this is a healthy way to do it. This is the way I did it. And I think being on autopilot for a while is what got me through law school, because otherwise it's hard. It's incredibly hard. It's incredibly draining. And if I had to think about it too deeply, I'm not sure I would have made it through.
So you come out of this experience thinking, I want to be a prosecutor. I want to help victims through these kinds of situations. And then what did that look like going forward?
Yeah. So I actually worked for a state's attorney's office in law school. I really enjoyed it. And then I went to work for 2 years for a judge in Baltimore County. That was the transformation for me because I sat in court every day. He had a lot of criminal dockets. I saw all kinds of people coming to court. And what I discovered for myself was seeing both sides of the story and that both sides were coming in with trauma. And I obviously already felt very compassionate and empathetic toward victims. I started to feel the same way toward a lot of the defendants who were coming into court and hearing their stories. And it really impacted me. And then I applied to the public defender's office after that experience to do post-conviction work.
That was your liberal heart. Your liberal heart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Your liberal heart was rearing its head.
Yeah.
And so then you began working for the public defender's office. And it wasn't until, I believe, you joined Marilyn Mosby's team, right? Like that you went back doing work on the prosecutorial side, right?
Right. Yeah. I was with the public defender's office in various capacities for about 15 years. And then when Marilyn Mosby announced this new division, which I thought was pretty revolutionary, the idea that prosecutors would be reviewing cases and making determinations if the sentence has been satisfied, Like, that's not a fit. That's not built into our system. It has not traditionally been built into our system.
Right. Conviction integrity units started 2010, 2008. But a sentence integrity unit, as you say, is pretty groundbreaking.
Yes. And I think we were the seventh one in the country when it was announced in 2020. And so I wanted to be a part of that. And it was also, it felt like a full circle moment for me to come back to the office that inspired me to become basically a criminal attorney and to work with victims again. So I thought, okay, I haven't been doing that as a public defender in this way. So now I want to, you know, I want to have this experience and I want to help. So yeah, I took the plunge and left the public defender's office and went to work at the sentence review unit.
In 2020.
In 2020.
Well, I hope you didn't regret it.
Well,
on the other side of it. Well, okay. So can I ask you, I'm just curious, did the sentencing review unit work with the conviction integrity unit at all? Or you kind of guys operated completely in separate silos?
It was pretty separate. Occasionally, like I would see a case that I thought they may take a look at or vice versa. So sometimes we moved cases around a little bit, but otherwise, it was very different. They're looking at innocence, and I'm looking at mainly the sentence. But looking at the sentence can involve a lot of things, and it did. It wasn't just, oh, what do I think about the sentence? It was looking at, was this appropriate at the time? What has the defendant done in the past 30 years? What did his trial look like? If he were tried today, would he have been convicted? Would he have gotten a sentence as harsh? We were looking at forensics and, oh, this person was convicted on faulty forensics. There is other evidence to maintain the conviction, but should we take that into consideration? And obviously the victim's opinion, when we were able to locate victim's family, we took their opinion into consideration as well. We took into consideration the parole history, you know, and obviously the facts of the case, you know. So there was a lot of work for each case to really pull it apart.
If I'm getting the timing right, I feel like it would have been shortly after you began working there that Adnan's case came to you then.
Yes. So I started in December 2020. The Juvenile Restoration Act passed, I believe, in May or April of 2021, and it was going to go into effect in October. So I was starting to get these cases or attorneys calling me and saying, hey, this is coming your way. I want to give you the heads up so you can start working on it, which I appreciated and I encouraged. And Adnan's case was one of the ones that came to me probably in May, I believe it was.
Yeah. We did explain in an episode already kind of like that trajectory, how all these things happened behind the scenes, that it was originally the anticipated petition was going to be a JRA petition. And you were kind of the lead on all of these cases or just Adnan's case? I don't know how the division of labor happened in your division.
So my division was a division of one. So okay.
I guess you were the lead.
I reviewed anything that any case that qualified under the Juvenile Restoration Act. So his and many, many others as well came to me. So yeah, that's how that happened.
So fast forwarding to kind of where we are today, you know, the world knows exactly what happened. They know procedurally what happened. And the most kind of recent big event in this case in court was when the state's attorney, Ivan Bates, essentially filed a motion to withdraw the motion to vacate, basically. And it was it was like 88 pages, right? And this is not something that we have talked about in depth or really at all, I think, on Undisclosed yet, Colin. But you know, you are in charge of this case, and a lot of what is talked about in this motion goes directly to the work that you did. So we thought we really wanted to kind of go through what Bates raises in the motion and to ask, is there a mechanism really for you or Mosby or anybody to even respond to this at this point? I feel like there isn't, right? Not in a legal way, right?
Right. This part is done. So we, because we're no longer in the office, don't have a mechanism to respond to what has been stated and alleged in Bates's motion. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say this, though, because like throughout the course of this case, all kinds of parties who were not parties to this case kept filing briefs and amicuses. All kinds of people were like jumping in. I was like, somebody needs to be like, I'm just doing an amicus to the court and responding to this. But anyhow, I want to talk about a few of the major issues that are raised in this motion.
Let's set the scene first, because Robbie, as you said, we haven't spoken about this. And so, Becky, if you can kind of lay out what your investigation found and what you set forth in the initial motion to vacate.
Yeah. So when I got this case, as we just talked about, I was focused on sentencing. So how long has he been in? What were the facts of the crime? What was his parole history like? Which there was none, because he was not eligible at the time I reviewed his case. And part of that was reading the trial transcripts to get a really good understanding of what the crime was. And so it was in the process of doing that, that I started having concerns. Now, I will tell you, as a post-conviction attorney for nearly 20 years and having represented hundreds of people convicted of murder in Maryland, I have never been more concerned reading a transcript that, oh my God, do we have the right guy? I've had many clients over the years say, I'm innocent. Some of them I believe, but couldn't prove it. But most of them, I would say, we're guilty. we got the right guy, you know, but the state got the right guy anyway. So I started getting very concerned just based on reading the transcript, nothing else. And I brought this to the attention of my supervisors. And they said, well, since you've... And you know how long that transcript is. Since you've already read this and spent God knows how many hours, just keep going. See, is there anything else? You know, review the state's file and the police file. And that's kind of what propelled me into is, did we have the right person? So I spent time at the attorney general's office. They would not release the trial files to us.
Is that unusual? That sounds weird. I mean, wouldn't they be like on the same page as the state's attorney's office?
Well, I would think so. And well, it was unusual that they took over the case for post-conviction and all the appeals after that. And I were basically acting as the prosecutor of the case. So I would have to make appointments to go over there, which I did. 17 boxes of materials. And I went through them twice because the first 7 boxes were not organized at all. It was just papers thrown into boxes. The last 10 or so were very organized. And those were the ones that were the appeals that Theroux handled, from what I could tell. Those were actually very organized. What I really wanted was the witness statements. And that was not easy to find. There was no file witness statements. I had to go through 17 files or 17 boxes. And it was at that time, you know, one of the issues that came to my attention was this note that I found, which I'm sure we'll be talking about. Another issue that really concerned me, and we can talk about this more too, was the cell phone tower evidence and the fact that the highest court of Maryland did not address it because, according to them, it was not preserved for their review. So given those things, I just kept looking and reviewing and went from there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
And if we go back to you mentioned that note you found in the files, and this is sort of the core Brady violation that you identified in the motion to vacate. And so this note in Kevin Urich, the trial prosecutor's handwriting, is setting forth what?
Yeah, so the note, well, first of all, it's undated. It doesn't say who the writer is, although we figured it out from other notes that it was Kevin Urich. It doesn't say who the speaker is, but the note lays out something to the effect of he threatened to kill the victim. And of course, that's an eye-opening, jaw-dropping kind of statement that needed us to look into further. Like, who are we talking about? When was this said? And all the things you need to kind of figure out to see what do we have here? Or is it a big nothing? Or is there something serious here that may not have been turned over?
And in terms of investigating that and coming to a conclusion that this is speaking to an alternate suspect having threatened to kill Hay as opposed to Adnan, can you sort of take us through your process of diving into that and coming to your conclusions?
Yeah. So I think first it's important for the audience to know that this was a team effort. This wasn't just me. This wasn't just me and Marilyn Mosby. The team that was reviewing this, obviously I was the lead reviewer, also included the deputy state's attorney, as well as general counsel. And we were all one team. We all reviewed every single piece of information together and made decisions based on that. So once we saw the note and what it said, we had to figure out, well, who said it and what was the context? And we were able to figure that out through a lot of investigation, which entailed, and I don't want to say the suspect's name or any names, frankly. I know that they're out there, but to me, it feels inappropriate unless they're charged. So I'm just going to be very vague in this podcast, but I'm sure people can figure it out. But through talking to the family members of the person who heard the statement being made and other sources like attorneys involved in various cases over the years, we were able to conclude and still feel this way today. We know who said it. We know why it was said, and that it was this suspect who said it. It was not Adnan who said it.
Yeah. And you also had to determine that for it to be Brady, that the defense never had a copy of this note. Like, it was not disclosed to the defense, right? And how were you able to do that?
Yeah. Okay. So that was several things. One, the note, again, it's undated. It's on a piece of paper. It's not documented anywhere else in the file. The information's not typed up. It's on a piece of paper with lines on it. And so all the other discovery in the file that I saw was written in a memorandum type format.
Right, right.
So it was clear it was conveying something. It wasn't just random attorney notes. So that was not done for this particular note. No documentation.
No indexing. Right. It's not
no indexing. Yeah. No mention of any of this anywhere else in the file. So that happened. We made sure that it was not in the defense attorney's file, which was voluminous. There was a lot of information in there, went through it multiple times. It was not in there. And based on the contents of the note, if Kevin Urich's version of this note is correct, which is it was Adnan who made the threat, nothing else happened after that, such as subpoenaing the person who said it, who he had subpoenaed before for grand jury. The person was available and known to him. That did not happen. So the thought that in open file discovery, a defense attorney should come over and find a handwritten note that doesn't say what it is, what date it is, what this is even about, and what it's conveying does not satisfy Brady. And I do not believe it was turned over. I think the fact that I don't know how many people have reviewed this file in 20 years. I think it's quite a bit, including journalists, and nobody has ever seen this note. Says to me, it was pulled as work product.
That note was never in any file that we ever saw. I can guarantee, because I promise you there would have been a whole undisclosed episode about it had there been. But I want to talk about a few of the ways that Ivan kind of attacks this note and why you believe it's Brady. First, he says in his motion that this is subject to multiple interpretations. Like, those are the exact words. And that it could have meant that it was Adnan, right? That who's saying that he threatened to kill her, even though it's vague. We don't know who the her is. We don't know who the he is. And when they checked with Yurik, apparently, according to Bates, that they spoke to ASA Yurik, and Yurik said that, well, he had a recollection of speaking to an anonymous female caller who conveyed this to him, but he had no way of contacting her. So he couldn't have subpoenaed her. He just like wrote this down and moved on. Can you respond to both of these issues about like the vagueness of, or can it really be interpreted in different ways? Number one. And number two, okay, if there's an anonymous caller, and how can he subpoena her then?
Okay. So I have a lot of thoughts about that. If it's an anonymous caller, it still needs to be turned over. Okay. And we know it was not an anonymous caller based on a lot of other documents that were found in the file contemporaneous with this note, which was fax sheets from the attorney.
And this is the attorney, by the way, of the woman, that caller, basically. The caller. The attorney mm-hmm. of the caller, right. And there, because there's another note that we're going to get to, too. But okay,
yes,
go on.
Yes, who was providing, in addition to letting the state know about this threat, let them know through records that the suspect had access to a gun, that this suspect had other dealings with young men. And I think there was one other document that was sent, but basically this attorney sent this information to the state and to the police. And it was obvious it was for the purpose of, please investigate this person.
This person, yeah. Now, I want to, for folks who might be a little bit confused, because we're not naming names, although the names are publicly easily available. This is one of the suspects that was not investigated in this case properly. And to set up the context, that female caller was in fact somebody he had gotten divorced from. It was his ex-wife, and it was her attorney contacting Yurik repeatedly to say, you got to look at this guy because of all these things. Just to be clear, when we say suspect, we're talking about that suspect and not Adnan at the time. So okay, fair enough. But what about the fact that Bates also says, well, how come you didn't speak to Yurik about this? Like, we spoke to him about this. Why during your investigation didn't you ask him about this note, or what is the kind of the basis of this, and why didn't you turn it over and all that?
Yeah. So that was another team decision that we talked about. And as you probably are aware, Kevin Yurik has some credibility issues that we were concerned with, particularly in this case of misleading witnesses, maybe even witness tampering when it comes to Asia McLean and what he told her she couldn't do. And then we have this note. We decided we had so much corroboration. We knew what the note said and what it was trying to convey and who said it, that we weren't going to believe whatever interpretation he had to say. And we turned out to be right. Because look at the bizarre interpretation that came out of it. And we did not include the note as an exhibit, and we've been criticized for that. But the reason that was done is because it was an ongoing investigation. We were very deliberate not naming suspects, and I still am today, 2 years later. And there were also serious concerns from the family of the person who gave us that information about their safety. And so I was not just going to put that, all of that, into a public document. It was enough that we had it. I showed it to the judge. We knew what it said, who said it, about when it was said, and why. And so that is why we didn't contact Yurik, because we did not have any faith or confidence and an explanation. And now that we have the explanation, it's completely unhelpful. And it's, in my opinion, an absurd explanation of what that was.
Another thing that Urich says is that, look, we had open file discovery, right? And we have proof. In fact, Bates documents, he cites all the different times that Gutierrez had access to the files, you know, and could have found this note in there herself. So then how do you defend that? Like, it's not that he obscured it on purpose, but you believe, you said that maybe it was removed as work product.
Yes, attorneys are not required to provide their work product, and work product is my thoughts about the case and my interview notes and things like that. But when you're interviewing a potential witness, that's very different. And because of how the note looked, it was just, you know, kind of scribble on a lined piece of paper. I do think it was pulled as work product whenever someone had to requested to look at the file. I assure you, no one, Kevin Urich and Kathleen Murphy, were not providing their work product to Christina Gutierrez about their thoughts of the case and what their opening and closings were going to be, all that stuff. And it's fair. You can pull work product. It's just, this wasn't that. And it should have been available.
And speaking to that point, in terms of corroboration, in a sense, of this not being turned over and the attorney is pulling it, there are other notes you found regarding Jay Wilds and a polygraph test, right?
Yes. Yes.
And so can you tell us a bit about what you found in the prosecutor's files about Jay Wilds and a polygraph?
Yes, I found a note authored by Kevin Urich and a note authored by Kathleen Murphy. It was like to-do lists. And both of them said, schedule Jay Wilds' lie detector test. And I thought, lie detector test? This is the first I'm hearing that there was a lie detector test. And then that was memorialized in a typed memo, but it just said, schedule Jay's appointment. And so when I left, I had a very lengthy meeting with the Baltimore Police Department about investigating these other suspects. And I asked if they were able to determine, one, did he show up for a lie detector? Was it ever scheduled? And if so, what were the results? I left in December of 2022, so I don't know the answer to that. I'll tell you what I think. It's my opinion is if he went in and passed, we'd have copies of it. You know, plenty of copies, and people be talking about it for the past 20 years. If he failed, took it and failed, that would be a Brady violation not to turn that over. Or if he declined to take it or did not show up for the appointment, I don't know if that's necessarily a Brady violation or not, but I think any of those possibilities other than he took it and passed are the most likely in this scenario. So I would love to know what happened there.
Yeah.
My question to that, and this is actually to both of you, Colin and Becky, Adnan's been arrested. Jay Wilds is like the only evidence. Why do you think that Kathleen Murphy or Kevin Urich would want to now polygraph him?
So I asked several state's attorneys this because this was a little surprising to me. The police use lie detector tests all the time to help, you know, guide investigations. I never have seen a state's attorney request one. I'm not saying that that's not done. I just personally have not seen it. And I did ask around in my office. I'm like, is this usual? Is this part of the practice? And they said occasionally, maybe, but generally no. So, you know, what it says to me is they had concerns about his story because they certainly don't put every witness through a lie detector test in every case. There's something about that maybe raised a flag for them.
And this is coming Jay's first recorded police interview, his second recorded police interview, his ride along March 15th, 1999. And then in April, in connection with the grand jury, there's a police memo about trying to iron out and correct details of Jay's prior statements. We're post-indictment now, and that is when this note, the notes by both Urich and Murphy appear about the polygraph. And so that's telling you the prosecutors don't have much faith even after the indictment in this story that Jay has told at least four times at this point.
Yeah. Your interpretation is a little more generous than mine, and maybe it's a difference without a distinction. And there is, I think that if they're scheduling these, they want these polygraphs, not because they want to make sure that this witness is credible, but they want to see if they can collect any more evidence, like a polygraph he passed, to convince a jury or to convince, you know what I mean? I mean, just to have more evidence that would help them, because all they have is his changing statements. So if they can say, well, he's passed a polygraph, then it's kind of like...
Give some legitimacy.
It gives them some legitimacy. It's like a CYA, right? Like, to me, it's a CYA versus a... Did we really get the right person? I just don't think they cared about that. I think they were like, how do we bolster this totally non-believable witness's statements? And I guess the question is, I mean, shouldn't there be a record of this somehow, somewhere? I mean,
yes.
Is that FOIA-able, do you think?
So
who wants to file that FOIA? One of our listeners will do it.
I feel like there should be a record of it. If an appointment was made, whether he came, whether he didn't come, and what the results were, if he came. It was not in the police file. I do know that. I had access to the entire police file.
And I think, right, like, wouldn't, if I'm not wrong, at the time, like, it's generally one person who does all of these, administers these tests.
Right.
Right? Like, it's, like, usually the same person. So maybe if that person is spoken, like, interviewed, and you didn't have a chance to interview that person?
No, I think he's now retired.
Yeah. Okay.
And speaking of polygraphs, we have the second alternate suspect mentioned in the motion to vacate. And we know he was given two polygraph tests. The first one he failed, the second one he passed. And so can you tell us a bit about this second alternate suspect and your investigation into him and what you found in terms of the location of Hayes' car, as well as other incidents of violence against women?
Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot in that question, Colin. So we'll start with the polygraph. In Bates's motion, they pretty much dismiss that allegation, saying that, well, polygraphs aren't admissible in court and the defense attorney knew about the polygraphs. Yes, correct. Don't disagree with that. The issue here is the fact that the second polygraph that was administered was not an appropriate polygraph to dismiss a person of interest. And so the point of raising that issue in the motion is that he's still a viable suspect. So don't just say, oh, well, he passed the second one, so it's not him. I'm saying that is incorrect. He needs to be polyed again if anyone wants to find out for sure. And this is the same person who discovered the body, whose house is just one block away from Woodlawn High School, who has a troubling history of sexual misconduct, who has a newer history of trying to assault women while naked while they're in their car. And the victim's car was found in front of one of his family members' houses. And so what are the odds of this? I mean, it's just too much. And so I still believe there needs to be more investigation. And if you're wondering, well, why didn't you do it, Becky? Well, so we had enough information at the time that we were very disturbed and believed that Anand deserved a new trial. So we started there. And because this was such a reversal of all of the other prosecutorial positions in this case, I was hopeful that this may message to the public, we're serious about this. Like, do you have information? And I was hoping it could also generate some leads. And, you know, there's only so much work we can do in a matter of time. So after the hearing, I was hoping to get some leads. And it was after the hearing, I went and met with the police and asked them to continue the investigation. Because at some point, most investigations need to be conducted by a police department.
Yeah. And in this particular suspect, well, actually, it's true for all the other suspects. It's like, there's no forensic evidence ever was collected from him. No hair, no DNA.
Right.
I don't even think he was fingerprinted in connection with this. Or, I mean, I don't know if his fingerprints are on file because of his other offenses, or I'm assuming they would be.
I think they would be, yeah.
But his DNA would not exist in CODIS.
No, because all of his offenses, I believe, are misdemeanors. Or right. If there are any felonies, it's excluded from the DNA law. So to my knowledge, we do not have his DNA.
Now, there's a lot of confusion and back and forth over the internet and with everything legally in this case about materials that may or may not have been found in his couch or under his couch. And so what can you tell us about what you know or don't know about these materials?
Yeah, so a search warrant was executed on this suspect's house. I forget the year, but it was in response to him being arrested for trying to attack the woman in the vehicle. It was a mail truck while he was naked, completely naked, by the way. And so they executed a search warrant of his house, and the police report, it indicated something that underneath the couch in the basement was a box of pornographic videos, but also news clippings from 1999. And so I thought, well, okay. And they weren't pornographic related, you know, it was news articles with the porn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I contacted that police officer who did the search, and he remembered a lot, but not enough. So he said, yes, I remember going into that house. I remember the search. I remember it was very strange that these materials were obviously secreted away and that there were news clippings, and someone had reminded me that he was involved in that case from 1999. And I thought that was really strange. And I said, well, do you remember the contents of the articles? Did you take pictures or anything? And he did not remember. So
that is insane to me. I'm sorry. How do you remember they're from 1999 but don't know what they're about? Are they sports articles? Are they about the economy, the weather, a murder that just happened? Like, how? I have a really hard time actually believing that. How does he remember it's from 1999 and not remember what it's about?
So it was in the police report that he wrote, I guess, within a day or so after the search, that it was 1999 newspaper articles. That's what turned me on to the fact that, oh, what the heck were these articles? And I contacted him, obviously, a couple years later.
And they wouldn't have collected that stuff. They left it there, right?
They left it there.
They put it right back under the couch.
They did.
How do I get to that couch? Oh, my Lord. I mean, yeah, that's something like straight out of a movie. It's crazy to me.
So you do your year-long investigation. The motion to vacate is presented. It's granted. The state appeals. Eventually, the Court of Appeals of Maryland sends it back down, says we need more notice to the victim's family. At this point, Ivan Bates has taken over. And what do you do in terms of, you've done this investigation, you're trying to help, the case is now down for him to decide what to do. How did you reach out to Bates, and what were your meetings with him like?
Yeah, so like I said, I left the office in December 2022. So the vacature hearing, I think, was in September. So I met with Mr. Bates in December before he took office at his private office a block away. And the purpose of the meeting was I wanted to talk to him about this case. And I said, you know, it's ongoing. This is a solvable case, in my opinion, and needs some additional resources. It's now with the police. I said, but here's all my information. Please call me, use me. I will be a resource. I can be a quiet resource. I don't care about credit. I don't want to be in the news. You can have whatever credit there is. I did not care. I was just hoping that he would continue the case. I also wanted him to know, you know, I wasn't leaving because he was elected. Because I know I left at the same time as Marilyn. That really just presented a good time for me to kind of exit. But I had known probably at the beginning of the year that would be my last year. My intentions of going there was to work there for a few years, 2 to 3 years was what was in my head, set up this unit, get all the policies and processes established, work through a lot of cases to see how this is supposed to go, and you know, do some lessons learned so I can hand this off to the next person. Obviously, there was no one else to hand it off to, sadly, but I wanted him to know that.
Wait, was the unit shut down after you left?
My understanding, and you may want to double check this, is they still have the conviction integrity unit, and I think they have something loosely called a sentence review unit, but it's just reviewing cases that come in under the JRA, whereas we had a much more expansive criteria. And I'm not sure that they're agreeing to a lot of releases.
So you met with them and then you said, I'm here as a resource. And so how many times were you used as a resource then?
No, it was a great meeting. I thought we got along great. And I gave him my personal cell phone number, my personal email address. What do you need? I even told him about a grant that I had gotten and wasn't able to use and said, I can set you up with the funder. It was a $100,000 grant for another attorney. Just let me know. I never heard from him again. And so it became what I've now learned is they did nothing with this case this entire time until they were forced to, once the case was remanded back from the Supreme Court of Maryland, because they didn't start their investigation, according to their own memo, until September of 2024. And then they contacted and met with Adnan's attorney. They met with the victim's attorney, both in September 2024. They contacted me at the end of December. And I'm thinking, why am I not one of the first people you call? I'm here. I didn't move. I've been in the same place. I'm very easy to find. And they sent it to an address that I don't even work at. So I didn't respond. I didn't get the letter. And then they contacted again through a generic email address at my organization at the time. And it did get to me. So it wasn't until January, and their response is due in February, that they contact me. And so to me, it began to feel like this was an attempt at showing due diligence.
Right. Just checking a box.
Checking a box. And so I wrote up, based on my memory, I don't have the files, what I did, why I came to the decisions that I did. It was like a 10-page memo I provided to them and said, let me know if you have any other questions.
Well, yeah, when they contacted you in December, is that what they were asking? Can you just give us an overview of what you did? Or
they asked for an interview, and I offered to provide them a written explanation of everything that happened and to answer any questions that they had in writing.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
And beyond the Brady violation, the two alternate suspects we mentioned, you brought up earlier, Adnan's PCR hearing has testimony by cell tower experts. Judge Welch finds Gutierrez was ineffective by not using the AT&T disclaimer about incoming calls not being reliable for location status. The appellate courts deny that issue, not on substantive grounds, but based upon it not being raised earlier. And so you said you noted this, and you didn't just sort of rest in the laurels of Judge Welch's decision. You actually did your own work on the cell tower pings. Is that correct?
Yeah. So let me explain this, because I feel like this is the lost issue. Everyone wants to talk about this Brady note. To me, the cell tower evidence is critical in this case. Without this, you don't have a case.
That's what Kevin Urich says himself. In his
right.
Yeah. To the
yeah. yeah. I'm not making this up. What I decided to do, I'm like, we're now looking at, do we have the right person? Not, was this entered into evidence correctly? Was this person cross-examined correctly? Like, you can go down those roads. I'm not looking at ineffective assistance of counsel. I want to know, is it even possible in 1999 to determine the location of a person based on the information that was available? And so, yes, I talked to four experts. I didn't disclose the names of the experts, and here's why. And I told Bates' team this. They all have security clearances and work for the Department of Defense. I didn't just call up and say, try to find some random witness. Mm-hmm. I went to, in my experience, the nation's leaders, if not the world's leaders, in cell phone technology. And I happen to have contacts there because I used to work there myself. So I know the people. That's how I was able to rely on them. And so it was, when you look at the standard for a vacature, it's, is this new information? Have you lost confidence in the verdict? I don't have to show, is this admissible? Is this, is there, and go down all those procedural paths. And when they looked at the information, they said, absolutely not could that witness have opined the location based on this information that he had at the time. So that was very powerful to me. It wasn't, is it admissible? It's, is it even possible? Is this even a thing? And so, I suggested to Bates' team, like, get another expert. They're out there. I might be able to find another one who will go on the record. They didn't do that. They didn't do that at all. They just said, oh, it's not admissible or whatever.
And how do you feel when you look at the motion to withdraw, the motion to vacate, a decent chunk of it is Bates speaking to the cell tower pings and arguing that Judge Welch got it wrong and that these pings were reliable. And so how did you feel in reading that section about the cell tower pings?
I feel like he missed the entire point that I was making. I wasn't saying Judge Welch was right. I wasn't saying he was wrong. I was saying, can we look at the technology that existed at the time?
Your own independent
yes.
analysis. Right.
And is this even possible to make this kind of determination? So this is going way deeper than what was done originally.
This is about innocence, not this about ineffective assistance.
This is about innocence. And exactly.
Yeah. It seems to me on this issue, and also, by the way, the DNA issue, which I want to talk about how you... what was the internal conversation before the charges were actually dropped based on the DNA results? But it seems to me like, you're saying that Bates and his team didn't go out and do an independent investigation to kind of make these determinations, that they were more focused on investigating the investigation, your investigation.
Right.
And is there any evidence that they did any independent investigation at all about the merits of your motion?
There is no evidence. And the reason I know this is because they provided an internal memo. So I was able to see who they interviewed, didn't interview, and what topics they reviewed. And there was no other independent investigation. It was just, here is what Becky wrote, or their interpretation of it, because they got it wrong a few times. And how can we discredit this?
Yeah. On the DNA evidence as well, they talk about this in the motion. And were you part of that decision after the DNA results came in for the shoes and everything?
So what I remember is the DNA was being analyzed. We had not gotten the results at the time of the vacature hearing.
Right.
And that was the main reason that we didn't dismiss the charges that day. That's actually what happened in the other 800 vacature hearings that were held in Baltimore City. The motion's granted, you dismiss the charges. But we decided not to because we wanted those DNA results back. And I also wanted to see what other information comes in. This could have been a retrial of Syed. This could have been a trial of someone else. But a big part of it hinged on the results, which we got a lot quicker than what we were expecting. I was thinking this is going to be months and months. We're going to have to postpone this trial. Like, I don't know how this is going to work out. But when we got them, and I remember Marilyn Mosby at the press conference at the vacature hearing saying, we're waiting on these results. And if it does not come back as a non or inconclusive, I'm going to dismiss the case. So I remember we got the results on a Friday, whatever day that was. And so, we reviewed them and made the decision to drop the charges that Monday. So that's how that came about.
And if we're laying out the facts for listeners who might have a general recollection. When Hay is found, she doesn't have her shoes on. The shoes are in the back seat of the car. Jay Wilds, in his police statement, says Adnan was touching a bunch of stuff in the back seat of the car. He left her shoes in the back seat. Does that all play into your analysis of when the DNA is tested on the shoes and Adnan is excluded, that this is exculpatory regarding Adnan committing this crime?
Okay, so it could be exculpatory. It could be nothing. So, and the reason I say this is someone took off her shoes and put them in the car. Okay,
right.
I suppose it's possible she took off her own shoes before she, but I find that incredible. So I believe the killers took them off and put them in there. Why they took off?
They're in the trunk of the car.
They're in the trunk.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so that's great. So actually, Jay's story is that Adnan puts Hay into the trunk of the car. These shoes are in the trunk. Someone obviously took those off. And if Jay's story is correct, Adnan, because Hay's not putting them in the trunk. Clearly, this would be Adnan, if Jay is right, putting her in the trunk and taking off the shoes.
Yeah.
Or the shoes just come off.
Right.
Yeah, so this could be someone who touched her shoes that was involved in this crime. It could be a random person's DNA from the fact that you walk around on all kinds of surfaces and stuff is picked up.
Members of her family. It could be like
members
of her family. Yeah, yeah. Was there any conversation about doing a genetic genealogy? Because, you know, the DNA could not be matched to anybody in CODIS. Is that right?
This is what I remember. It was compared to Adnan and Jay. Was it run through CODIS? I don't think it was. I could be wrong about that, though.
Okay. Well, that might be a place to start if you can't get a match anywhere to run the DNA through CODIS, Baltimore Police, if you're listening. But in Ivan's motion, he does mention, I believe, that there was an attempt to collect the DNA evidence from the suspect who failed the polygraph test. We all know who that is. But there was no usable DNA found from the evidence,
right,
from like the trash that was pulled, unfortunately. So there was an attempt to make a match there. But
right. We did do that and we weren't able to find any DNA. The evidence was sent back to the Baltimore Police Department. And I had a conversation with the director there about, okay, what else can we do with the clothes? And we talked about other types of testing that could be done. And so she was going to look into that. And then, of course, I left. So I don't know, but I think it should be done. Like, what else is, why not? Just to put the pin in that.
My investigator was able to get some usable DNA from that suspect's trash.
Okay.
And we have turned that over to Bates. So, but it's unlikely that he's going to go anywhere with this, the DNA at least. So there's a couple other things that I wanted to talk about because these are like issues that Bates raises in his memo. One is that he cites a memo in which he says that your investigative team lists five options to exonerate or release Adnan, but none of those options are that, oh, he might actually be guilty. So it shows that, you know, well, we could do the JRA, we could do this, we could do this. Like, it seems like he lists a whole thing of like, you know, the considerations you guys had and the options you had, but so what he's trying to say, or what he actually says, is that your team had already predetermined, or maybe Mosby had predetermined, that we have to find a way to release Adnan Syed. And these are the options to go through that. Can you address that, please?
Yeah. So one, that's completely untrue. And this is evidence of Ivan Bates misleading the public, because he got that information from a memo that I provided to his team, which said, here are some of the avenues we were looking at, if any. And that's classic lawyer speak, meaning or nothing at all.
Or nothing, yeah. That's what
it
means.
So he left that out of his motion, the or nothing at all piece.
Yeah.
So of course.
And it's not just misleading the public. This is in his memo that he filed
in court. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is very misleading, and not only it's just straight out wrong. It's completely inaccurate, and he knows it.
There's also, and this is all going to one more level of this train of thought, is the accusation that the reason that Mosby already had predetermined was because she thought this was going to help her with her federal charges she was facing, or the publicity was going to help, or there was, I mean, I was told online that, you know what, I mean, I was threatened online. I haven't talked about this on Undisclosed at all yet, but I was threatened by people online saying, we know that you were colluding with Mosby to get this result so she could get publicity and be featured in the documentary and avoid these charges. I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking. I've never spoken to the woman in my life or met her. And I was told that, you know, the feds are going to come and go through your stuff. I'm like, okay. I mean, I don't know what you want me to say. I don't know her at all. I've never had this conversation. And so this accusation that this was done just to help, this whole thing was just one big setup to help Marilyn Mosby face her federal charges. What is your response to that?
So I have several responses to that question. One is the people who think that don't know me and the years of service I have dedicated in my life to criminal justice. I've always acted with integrity, professionalism, and honesty. And it's obviously people that don't know why I got into this work. My own brother was killed, and it was 1 year after Hay was killed. And so the thought that I would concoct some crazy reasons to bring in a high-profile case is ridiculous. And it's frankly, it's disgusting to me. And it's been very upsetting to me personally hearing that. My other response is, a lot of people do believe that. And I thought, how would this help you in your federal case? Like, I don't even know how that would be possible. But I will tell you, yes, we were all aware of Marilyn's case. I never talked to her about it. It was never discussed one way or the other. And the case took as long as it took. And when it was ready to be filed, it was filed. It happened to be before, I don't know, what was it, a week or two before her federal case was to begin. Frankly, we had a lot of information prior to the election. Like if this was truly some concoction, we could have concocted some more stuff before the election. And maybe that would have been more beneficial. But that was never the point of doing this. It was always, we got to get it right. We need to honor the process. We need to honor the victims. This is too big to mess up. That was always the messaging that I got. And that's what I believe personally, too. People are going to believe what they want to believe.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of information, obviously, that the public doesn't have access to. But I want to talk about something that I think, to me, clearly shows that there was no kind of concerted effort. There was no predetermination that we're going to exonerate Adnan in one way or the other, or that's going to be the stated outcome. And that is this. So the Adnan's vacature hearing was on September 19th, 2022. There is an email from Marilyn Mosby to this team, your team, a few days later, September 22nd, in which she's talking about whether or not to release those handwritten notes that we have discussed, the ones that we believe that, you know, were Brady material, whether or not to release them to the Baltimore Banner. And here's what Mosby said. Releasing this note may be problematic for not only the pending investigation against the alternative suspects, but also against Saith, should we elect to try him. It's actual evidence in an open and pending investigation. We haven't cleared Saith yet. So even a few days after his conviction has been, you know, overturned, he's been granted a new trial, Marilyn Mosby is saying in an email to her own team, we haven't cleared him yet. We might try him again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's not publicly known information, but I wanted to share that. And but, you know, who would know this information, I'm assuming, is Ivan Bates. Right? Wouldn't they have this information that this email? Because, I mean, I'm guessing during the course of an investigation, they had access to all these communications.
Yes. It was obvious that they pulled all of our emails when they were investigating our investigation. So I assume that they would have seen this as well. I would note that in the absence of information, they would make assumptions. So instead of calling me and saying, hey, why did you do this way? Or what happened with this? They would make an assumptions, and the assumptions were always to the detriment of his predecessor. So never gave, like, there was no, let's give her the
benefit of the doubt.
Thank you. Yeah. There's no benefit of the doubts.
I mean, there's a lot of things that I, you know, that just seems like so illogical to me, including things like they're saying, well, Yurik doesn't really recall, but Yurik recalls that it was Adnan that the note was talking. I mean, like, he recalls what he wants to recall, but doesn't recall what he doesn't want to recall. And of course, the question of like, okay, if it was Adnan, then why wouldn't you find this witness and present this witness court? Of course you would. Of course you would. And then, you know, there's also the issue of Adnan himself. This is in Bates' memo, in Bates' motion, excuse me, that Adnan himself was saying to his legal team at the time, bringing up this alternate suspect and saying, you know, maybe like he had some concerns that maybe you should look into him, which to me means Adnan himself is like, I don't know what's going on, but somebody like talk to any of these people and see what you can find on somebody else versus him being like, you know, being able to direct his team in a certain way. To me, that's evidence of Adnan also trying to like figure out like what's going on and maybe also being, you know, suspecting this suspect, right? Like, and then Adnan knew him. It's somebody that he had known for a number of years. So, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of kind of like little illogical conclusions that I feel like that to me seem predetermined on this end from Bates' motion versus you guys being predetermined.
Years ago, we, through contact with a member of Metro Crime Stoppers, learned that $3,075 in a Crime Stoppers reward was paid out to a tipster. We did a whole episode investigating who was the tipster who was paid, and I believe as part of your investigation, you tried to look into this. Is that correct?
Yeah, so when I met with the Baltimore police after the vacature hearing, I spent 8 hours with them going through all kinds of information about the two suspects. And I also brought up the Crime Stoppers money. And they indicated to me that they could absolutely find out who the recipient was. Now, again, I left the next month. And that's when I turned it over. I thought I was turning it over to Ivan. He obviously didn't do anything with it. So I still don't know the answer to that.
Right. So in other words, whoever is in that office currently, Ivan Bates, should be able to communicate with them and find out the identity of the paid tipster.
Yeah. Based on what the detective told me, yes.
Colin, isn't that foyable now that this case is closed?
Becky, do you have any idea about who for an MPIA request you would reach out to try to get information on Crime Stoppers?
I don't. And it's anonymous for a reason. So I feel like the only exceptions would be a state's attorney's office getting the information. But I don't know. This is the first time I ever dealt with a Crime Stopper thing before. So yeah, yeah. I really don't know.
Many years ago, we had, a board member from Crime Stoppers came forward and said, oh yeah, it's in that file. It's there. And then that was it.
Yeah,
but we couldn't get. Yeah, we couldn't get a hold of. We couldn't get the actual information.
Is there anything else in your year-long investigation that maybe hasn't made it to the light of day that you want to share at this point?
What I would like to just touch upon is in 88 pages, Ivan Bates' team does not address, it looks like, three issues entirely, and I assume that's because they couldn't find a way to discredit it in a viable way or, you know, a not so viable way. And for example, that the car was found behind a family member's home of one of the suspects. They don't address that at all. To me, I think that's huge. That's very, very concerning and needs to be looked into. They did not discuss how Christina Vinson's testimony was found to be unreliable, which means that Jay Wilds was not truthful when he testified he was at her house that day.
This relating to her class schedule and the grade she received in the class, right?
They don't address that. They pretty much dismiss the allegation about one of the suspects trying to attack another woman in her vehicle. And to me, yes, that happened years later, but when you're looking at the whole picture of a person and what their tendencies may be, especially when there's a lot of other evidence that is concerning around this person, just to dismiss this as like no big deal was wild to me. So there were things that were just arguments just not addressed at all. But then there were other ones that were kind of dismissed in a way that didn't make sense to me and missed the mark of what I was trying to convey, which was the other suspect being engaged in sexual violence against men and against his wife. They just dismiss it as propensity evidence. But again, these acts occurred, actually one was fairly simultaneous. But if you're looking at a suspect and what they're capable of, and what their tendencies are or proclivities are or could be, when you see someone this violent, to engage in rape, for example, how does that not like make the hairs on your neck stand up just a little bit and say, well, maybe I should look into this guy?
Yeah. And, you know, look, there are people, listeners who are going to say, well, I mean, like, it can't be everybody, but it's not. It's either this person. And that's not the point of this. The point of this is that if this evidence was, if any of this was presented at trial, would this have, could have had a difference in the jury's determination, which is part of the consideration in all of this, right? Like, would there have, could have been a material, what is the language, Colin? Tell me again.
Material exculpatory evidence.
That's right. Like, so could this have changed the jury's mind? Would this have mattered anyways if any of this had been presented at trial? Becky, I want to ask you, and we, you know, it is public information and knowledge because Marilyn Mosby herself has talked about the fact that Ivan Bates, and I think it seems almost unprecedented. I don't think I've seen this ever before, where the new state's attorney files an attorney grievance complaint against the previous state's attorney for this investigation, for this motion to vacate Adnan's conviction. And I wanted to ask you, can you just respond to the fact that he's filed this complaint against her? And what is happening? Why is this happening, do you think? Like, we have our hypothesis. It's just like a political thing. But what? What?
I
mean, what is the misconduct he's alleging? Like, he's alleging, he's not just saying, look, we looked at the same stuff. We come to different conclusions, which happens all the time, right? Like, we'll present all kinds of evidence to our listeners. People come to different conclusions. He's saying that Mosby misrepresented things to the court. Like, that's the complaint.
Yeah. So I can just say his complaint is him attaching his 88-page motion to a letter. Why is he doing this? I don't know. I have some thoughts. I have some theories. But I don't know. And as I went through the motion and saw, oh, I see, he selectively picked issues he wanted to address. And in some of the issues he wanted to address, he did not include all the information that was provided. So he selectively included which information to provide. He used incorrect standards to review some of the information. And so if there's an allegation of misrepresentation, someone needs to look at his motion.
I was going to say, it can go both ways.
Yeah, it's really, it's very concerning how he chose to frame and dismiss and disregard many of the issues in the motion. And, you know, when this was filed, you know, my heart sank and I thought, oh my God, didn't forget to carry the one? What did I miss? You know, that's where I go because I think that I'm a very open and honest person. And like, I appreciate feedback and I'm not perfect. I try really hard, but I certainly am not. Did I miss something? Did I use the wrong analysis? And as I went through, I was like, oh no, that's not it at all. Now I see what this is. So that's very upsetting on so many levels.
Yeah. And she could lose her law license based on this, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, when a complaint is filed, any number of things can happen. It could be dismissed outright. It could be docketed for further review, in which you could get like no sanction, or you can get suspended. You could get a letter of reprimand, or you could lose your license. So there's a lot of different ways this could play out.
Becky, my last question for you is just, is there anything else you want to share about your experience working on this case or regarding the motion to withdraw, the motion to vacate?
I think what I really want folks to know is I want them to know me, and that this was by no means some type of political stunt whatsoever. And it came from a legitimate concern that we didn't get the right guy, or we might not have gotten the right guy. And it just went from there. I had no interest in this case whatsoever when it came to me. So much so I didn't start looking at it till months later. It wasn't like, oh, I got it. And I just couldn't, I started working on it right away. I did not. It took months for me to even crack the file open. And the same with Marilyn. Like, there was no urgency. It was, you review the case in your time. And what I would do is I would review cases in the order that they applied to me, whether they had an attorney or not. And so he did not get any special treatment. I reviewed the case when it was time to review his case. And it really was born out of a concern. And so that the public narrative has been so morphed into this, you know, this public stunt narrative is very upsetting. And it's been upsetting to me for years, to the extent I don't even practice law anymore. I needed to take a break, and maybe a permanent one. And the reason is, it's not just this case. There's a lot of other little things too. But to see how many people with power came out to do what they could to keep a conviction in place and to discredit four women team and to attack our reputations and our credibility is not okay. It's not okay. You can disagree. You can say, I would have done it this way, whatever. That's not what was done here. And we have become collateral damage in whatever this is, why he changed positions like that, and why he felt the need to accuse us of misrepresentation and lying to the court. It's not okay.
Yeah. And I think Adnan has also become collateral damage in all of this.
Of course.
Because at the end of the day, it's never felt like it's been about the merits. It's just felt like egos, power. I don't know what. I don't know how to explain all the different state's attorneys and how they've been acting on this. It's been crazy. All right. Well, Becky, thank you so much.
Yeah,
you are
thanks.
Always welcome back to talk about this or any case you'd like to. And we wish you well. And I completely understand the desire to just walk away from practicing law. But, you know, I am looking to the future and I am scanning the skies to see who is going to be the next Baltimore City State's attorney. And, you know, think about it. That's all I'm going to say. Give it a thought. Anyhow, I just thank you again so much. And thank you for all the work you've done. And you have just done incredible work in your career. And meaningful work has had lasting impact on so many hundreds of people. So we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining Colin and I this week with Becky Feldman. We hope you learned a lot. And I know I did. And, you know, just keep an eye out for what happens next, because, you know, this case is just so many things you don't expect, with Ivan Bates filing a complaint against Marilyn Mosby. What we didn't discuss here, but Marilyn Mosby has sort of said publicly, is that Ivan Bates also filed an attorney grievance commission complaint against Becky Feldman. And we weren't going to discuss that because she's really not at liberty to. These are all confidential matters, although Marilyn Mosby has elected to speak about the complaint publicly. So Ivan Bates is also going after Becky Feldman's law license. And if you find that egregious, you should. All right. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with an update on a couple of our cases. You don't want to miss that. And stay tuned for the rest of the summer and as we lead into our fall season, which you will not want to miss. Thank you guys for your support.
Hey guys, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Want to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production and Animal Weapon for our theme music. This time around, we're doing something different. You can leave us questions, comments, thoughts, and suggestions in a voice note, and we might even play it on air. Just go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed and start recording. For those of you that want to engage on social media, you can follow, share, and like us on all the different platforms. We're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. For folks on X, we're still at Undisclosed Pod. Also, please go to subscribe to our new YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod so you don't miss out on any content there. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you want to follow Colin and Rabia on social media as well, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram, and Colin is at EvidenceProf on Instagram and Blue Sky. Thanks for your continued support for us and for our sponsors. Until next time.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQBar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQBar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQBar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQBar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.